You can meet and hear Anthony Esselin, John Warwick Montgomery, Ryan Anderson, Bev Yonke, Mark Kaltoff, and Chris Rosebro at the 2018 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas, Texas. Early bird registration is $110. For more information, visit issuesetc.org. The Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 9th and 10th in Dallas. There's no doubt about it. Pope Francis is a different kind of pope, especially different from his two predecessors, Pope John Paul II and Benedict XVI. Both of them were considered, well, very conservative popes theologically on social and moral issues, not only in terms of their theology, but in terms of how they advocated for those things. Both of them were also very popular among Roman Catholic youth worldwide. Now, it appears that Pope Benedict has some of those qualities as well, and it appears that Pope Francis has some of those qualities as well, but he is a different kind of pope. The media seems to like him a lot more than they liked Pope John Paul II, and much more than they like Pope Benedict XVI. Why is that? What is the so-called Francis effect? And when it comes to the media, is this pope media savvy or is he media naive? It's sometimes hard to tell. Is he, in fact, the liberal pope that liberal Roman Catholics have been dreaming of for so many decades? Joining us to answer some of those questions, Ross Douthat. He's an op-ed columnist for the New York Times, film critic for National Review, and author of several books, including his latest, To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism. Ross, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Is Pope Francis the pope that liberal Roman Catholics have been dreaming of for so many decades?
I think within the limits of plausibility, he absolutely is. Essentially, the Pope has, in various ways, done what he can to essentially shift Catholicism's formal public attitude toward a lot of stuff associated with the sexual revolution, which has been sort of the point of controversy and tension within the Church going back to the 1960s and 1970s and the aftermath of the Second Vatican Council. And I say within the limits of plausibility because what the Pope has done is it's sort of a shift of attitude and atmosphere with sort of formal changes carried out ambiguously and in footnotes to longer documents and so on. So he isn't coming out and saying, you know, Catholicism is changing its teachings on divorce and remarriage or same-sex marriage and homosexuality or contraception. He isn't making the kind of sort of formal changes that conservative Catholics say he actually can't make, right? It's sort of, these are changes that are supposed to be impossible for a pope to make. So he hasn't gone that far. He's operated in this sort of zone of ambiguity where you're essentially saying, well, the Church still has these teachings. They exist somewhere in the ideal, in the abstract, but the Church is going to live in reality from now on. And that means sort of coming to terms with, you know, the post-sexual revolution world as it actually exists.
With that said, does he spell the end for conservative Roman Catholicism, at least in an official sense?
No, I think he has ushered in a kind of intellectual crisis for conservative Catholics, where, you know, the conservative view of the last 50 years or so was that, you know, you had the Second Vatican Council in the Church, which made a lot of changes to Church liturgy, you know, the Mass stopped being in Latin, you know, you had big changes to sort of everyday Catholic life, an end to the rule that said you couldn't eat meat on Fridays and so on. But it didn't make sort of explicit doctrinal changes or explicit changes to moral teachings, again, especially these controversial ones having to do with sex and marriage. So conservatives sort of told themselves that we had this council, it made some changes, we've accepted the changes, but then we had a couple of popes come along, John Paul II and Benedict XVI, who gave us a sort of official interpretation of the council, who ruled out a lot of more liberal ideas, and so things were settled. And Francis has basically come along and unsettled things and sort of said, well, again, without sort of making explicit formal changes, has sort of widened the zone of debate dramatically, has made sort of implicit changes that at least come close to things conservative Catholics said the Pope couldn't or shouldn't do. And so what's that sort of left conservative Catholics without a clear synthesis, I think? They had a story that they told themselves. The story has sort of run aground on historical reality at the moment, and they need to sort of figure out what happens next. But the Pope has not taken steps that would sort of make the conservative position completely untenable, right? The Pope has not stood up and said, all right, we're no longer going to say that same-sex intercourse is a sin, and we're going to start marrying gay couples in St. Peter or something. He hasn't done anything like that that would sort of provoke a literal crisis of faith within the church. He's operated much more ambiguously, and that has left conservatives with room to tell themselves, well, the Pope is still the Pope, but it's left their intellectual view of what was going on in Catholicism in kind of in tatters, I think.
Is this why you speak about Francis kind of returning to the spirit of 1970s Catholicism?
Yeah, well, they're right. There's this whole argument about sort of the letter of the Second Vatican Council versus the supposed spirit of the council. And conservatives have tended to appeal to the letter, and liberals and would-be reformers have said, well, there was also a spirit of the council that didn't officially make changes but implied this openness to sort of further ongoing change. And the truth of the matter is they're both right. That, you know, if you go back and look at both the history of the Second Vatican Council and the documents themselves, that sort of tension between the letter and the spirit was part of the council. There were people who wanted to go further and people who were more conservative, and the way it got ironed out was these documents that were open to multiple interpretations, sort of didn't make changes explicitly, but did seem to sort of usher in a new paradigm, which is that's a word that some of Francis's admirers in the church use a lot, new paradigm. So it created this ambiguity that, again, conservatives were arguing John Paul II and Benedict had resolved. And Francis has come along and demonstrated that what one pair of popes can do, another pope can effectively undo.
You speak of overconfidence on the part of conservative Roman Catholics through the time of John Paul II and Benedict XVI.
Yes, absolutely. And I should say, I'm speaking as one of them. I am some sort of conservative Catholic, and so the intellectual crisis or uncertainty that I'm describing is one that I myself share. But no, when I became a Catholic as a teenager with my whole family, so I'm neither a cradle Catholic nor an adult convert. I'm that little-known third category. But when I came into the church, it was the late 1990s. John Paul II was sort of still healthy and sort of intellectually vigorous. And I entered into a sort of conservative wing of the church that really had this story that they had all but won the battles over interpretation, and that, you know, John Paul II had showed that the conservative view was the only way to interpret Vatican II, and he had sort of held the line on all these questions, married priests, female priests, obviously abortion, euthanasia, same-sex marriage, and so on. And at the same time, there was this confidence that he had created this generation of younger bishops and younger priests and younger sisters who were more sort of zealous and orthodox in their faith, and they were going to inherit the church, and that the sort of liberal wing had failed to reproduce itself in sort of literal biological terms and also in terms of vocations and bishops and so on. And that wasn't completely wrong, right? There is still this real gulf, you know, if you look at sort of younger priests, sort of younger figures in the church, they do tend to be more conservative. You do have this strange dynamic of sort of older liberals and younger conservatives in the church. But that wasn't the only dynamic. And it was also true that conservative Catholicism in many ways was still a sort of weak subculture within the church, that big, important institutions in the church were still controlled by more liberal Catholics, that liberal Catholicism generally had more cultural appeal than conservatives wanted to admit. And also, there were just lots of, you know, the church is filled with human beings, and there were lots of bishops and cardinals who were conservative when there is a conservative pope, and if you get a liberal pope, they'll find reasons to be liberal. And then finally, you know, since this is the story that's dominating news about the church right now, conservative Catholics just underestimated the extent of moral rot. And, you know, this wasn't unique to them. I think liberal Catholics underestimated it, too. But, you know, we're watching this play out with Cardinal McCarrick, the former Archbishop of Washington, who had come out, not only molested and abused seminarians, but teenagers as well. And, you know, from the first wave of sex abuse scandals in the early 2000s through the present day, I think conservatives have gotten a real education in how much corruption John Paul II sort of failed to deal with and turned a blind eye to. And that's a big part of the story of Catholicism over the last couple generations, too. Just, you know, this has been an era of profound moral corruption in the clergy in ways that should make every faction in the church uncertain about the proper response and the state of things overall.
We're talking with Russ Douthat of the New York Times, author of the book To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism. When we come back, what is the so-called Francis effect? Stay tuned.
Western civilization, infant baptism, transgenderism, a legal case for the resurrection, the First Amendment, revisionist history. Your favorite guests will address these topics at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 9th and 10th in Dallas. Learn more at issuesetc.org. Making the Case, November 9th and 10th in Dallas. Dallas Days, Fort Worth
Night. We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Things when I hear on the radio tonight about Obama being a Christian but not being good because of his pro-choice and homosexuality stances.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Yet I see no evidence of any literature that in the Bible that you stated that says that these things are against biblical teachings.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
Issues Etc. returned to the air on June 30th after being canceled by the previous leadership of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod during Holy Week of 2008. For a special 10-year anniversary donation of $100 or more, we'll send you a CD of Issues Etc. listeners' top 12 hymns. You can make an anniversary gift online at issuesetc.org or by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
It can be tough to be Lutheran in America these days. Everything we hold dear seems to be under fire. Our families, our schools and churches, even our most deeply held beliefs. We need clarity amid the chaos. Unchanging truth in a world of lies. The Lutheran Witness can help. Get the best of Lutheran reflection on faith and life, theology and culture. Learn more at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective.
40 years greatly blessed is this year's theme at Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois. We engage young adults in a Christ-centered environment and provide an alternative to secular public high schools. Please help us provide tuition assistance to more students by making a special 40th anniversary tax-deductible gift at melhs.org and click on the giving page. Or call me, Dr. Jay Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about Pope Francis and the future of the Roman Catholic Church on this Monday, July the 23rd. Russ Douthat of the New York Times is our guest. He's author of several books, including his latest, To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism. Russ, what is the Francis effect?
The Francis effect that we can measure is a dramatic change in media perceptions of the papacy, the Vatican, and obviously Francis himself. You know, from the very beginning, Francis has been a media phenomenon. He has, you know, sort of he has a great aptitude for sort of creating arresting images and visuals and sort of this sort of public imitation of Christ that, you know, that makes for great media, makes for great video and great photographs and so on, and that fits. And he, you know, he travels well, like John Paul II. He can be a bit of a rock star, you know, in a way that Benedict XVI, who was much more of sort of effectively had the personality of a librarian, did not. And so there was a clear Francis effect where the church's reputation was in bad shape. Benedict XVI was sort of disliked by the secular media in various ways. And Francis came in and turned things very, very quickly in ways that surprised even me. I would never have imagined that just electing a different pope could change media coverage of Catholicism so dramatically. So that's the definite Francis effect. The indefinite one is what all this means for the long term. A lot of the long-term legacy of Francis is more sort of liberalizing approach depends on whether, you know, does it succeed in bringing people back to the pews? Does it succeed in inspiring vocations to the priesthood? Does it give a more liberal form of Catholicism what it sort of lacked, a kind of, you know, active younger religious foundation in terms of the sheer numbers you need to run the church? And that there, the evidence is mixed and spotty, and we won't know for 25 or 50 years what the long-term Francis effect really is.
Have the media fairly covered Francis in the sense that conservative Roman Catholics say, look, they have over-covered his liberalizing tendencies and undercovered his traditional tendencies?
Yeah, I think the media has... I would defend the media's approach there. I mean, yes, it's certainly true that Francis says things about abortion and homosexuality and a whole wide array of topics that if Benedict XVI had said them, the media would have covered in the most hostile possible way. And when Francis says it, it's a one-day story and it tends to disappear. At the same time, the press is not wrong that these liberalizing moves are a really interesting and important feature of his pontificate, right? That, you know, it's not news if a pope is saying the same things as his predecessors, because that's what popes usually do. It is news if the pope is, as Francis did, devoting two consecutive meetings of bishops in Rome to trying to arm twist the world's bishops into shifting how the church approaches divorce and remarriage. That's a big story. The media isn't wrong to cover it, and they aren't wrong to see it as a kind of, you know, a potentially defining aspect of his pontificate. I think the fairest critique of the media coverage is around sex abuse stuff, that Francis has gotten a little bit more of a pass on those issues because he's seen as a liberal and a reformer than, say, Benedict did. And again, with the ongoing stuff with Cardinal McCarrick was intimately connected to a whole network of people, including a couple newly appointed cardinals who are sort of big supporters of Pope Francis. And I think if you played out the McCarrick scandal with a conservative cardinal who was close to a conservative pope, there would be much more media focus on what's the pope going to say about this? When is he going to address it? This goes all the way to the Vatican. And that's where I think if there's media bias, it creeps in a little bit and Francis escapes a little more. But on the liberalizing stuff, I think that deserves the coverage that it's gotten. That's what's really interesting about this papacy.
Is Francis himself media savvy or media naive?
Savvy. Look, he's not, you know, he's not on Twitter and Instagram. He's not savvy in the way of a millennial, to be cliched for a minute. But I think he has a very clear sense of how his different gestures and actions play. So, for instance, there's been this ongoing thing where he goes and gives interviews to this 90-year-old atheist Italian journalist named Eugenio Scalfari. And in these interviews, Scalfari doesn't take notes and then writes stories that are sort of after-the-fact reconstructions in which he usually says, you know, he usually quotes the Pope saying something that is, if not heretical, at least, you know, sort of straying outside the bounds of normal things the Pope would say. And the last case was around Easter. He had the Pope saying that he didn't think eternal damnation existed and that wicked souls were just annihilated. Now, if Francis did that once and had this kind of interview published and got burned by it and never did it again, you would say, oh, well, he's media naive. He didn't understand how this would work. But he's gone back and back to Scalfari over and over again. And each time the Vatican says, well, we can't confirm that's what the Pope says. To me, that is a sign that the Pope is savvy and sees this as a way for him to, you know, not change doctrine, but to sort of float trial balloons, widen the scope of permissible debate, sort of get people's attention and so on. And so he sees an advantage in being quoted in a way that isn't formal and can be denied by the Vatican. So I tend to give the Pope credit for knowing, not always, of course, but for generally knowing what he's doing and having a strategic sense of things. And I think that's, you know, people who are much more plugged in the Vatican than I do have the same sense that, you know, Francis keeps his own counsel. He has people around him, but he makes his own decisions. And, you know, he's a smart guy. I don't think he's just sort of naively drifting from controversy to controversy.
What did you make of his now famous, "Who am I to judge?" comment? Give us the context for that, and what did you make of it?
So the context was his first real papal press conference. He was flying back from a visit to Latin America, and there were, as there have continued to be, sort of scandals and controversies related to gay priests or priests accused of having gay lovers, and this included one of his appointees, and this led into a bigger discussion where he basically said, if somebody is gay and seeking the Lord, who am I to judge? And I think it was a sort of classic Francis utterance, because on the one hand, it was in certain ways just a statement of traditional Catholic teaching, which says homosexuality, being attracted to people of the same sex, is not itself a sin. Gay people are called to holiness just the same as straight people. There's no reason a gay person can't be a saint, even as most straight people are terrible sinners, right? But at the same time, the framework, the language, the rhetoric, and so on, the way he approached it was, you know, it was read in the press as a rhetorical shift from his predecessors. And I think that's sort of a case study in how he's operated. He's found language and sort of rhetorical frameworks and emphases and so on that have allowed people who want to see the church changing to see the church changing, even as it's sort of preserved a kind of deniability about whether anything has actually changed.
What do people need to know about Francis's pre-papal track record, his time in the church in South America before being elevated to the papacy, to understand him today?
I mean, I think, you know, Francis was elevated to leadership at a very young age. He was a leader within the local province, as they're called, the sort of local organization of his own Jesuit order in Argentina. And this was in the late 60s and early 1970s. And his tenure there was extremely controversial. On the one hand, you know, he had lots of people who admired him incredibly. There was sort of a brief spike in vocations and ordinations. At the same time, he made a ton of enemies who ultimately sort of got the upper hand, and he ended up sort of in a kind of temporary exile before he was plucked to become a bishop. And what's interesting is that the ideological dynamics were slightly reversed. He was then seen as a more conservative figure. The people criticizing him were more left-wing and radical priests, which is why when he became pope, there were people who sort of thought of him as a conservative Jesuit rather than the more liberalizing figure he's come to be. So there's been a kind of reversal of where Francis stands in the kind of theological, ideological battles within the church. But there's also a commonality where he is charismatic and dynamic and polarizing. And so, you know, his papacy, like his very first important position, it's a high risk, high reward kind of dynamic. He could be remembered as a great pope. He could be remembered as a disaster.
Ross Douthat is our guest, op-ed columnist for the New York Times and author of the book To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism. When we come back, what institutional changes has Francis made that will help us understand him. Stay tuned.
Hey, Todd. What have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Others talk. We have something to say. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th Century. The 4th Century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilker. We're talking about Pope Francis and the future of the Roman Catholic Church. Ross Douthat is our guest, op-ed columnist for the New York Times, film critic for National Review, and author of several books, including his latest, To Change the Church, Pope Francis, and the Future of Catholicism. The Issues, Etc. Making the Case conferences feature the best of Issues, Etc. guests and topics. This year's fall conference, that's no exception. You can meet and hear Dr. Anthony Esselin, author of Out of the Ashes, Dr. Ryan Anderson of the Heritage Foundation, Dr. Mark Kaltoff of Hillsdale College, Dr. Beverly Yonke of Doxology, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery of 1517 The Legacy Project, and Pastor Chris Roseborough of Fighting for the Faith. Attendance is limited to 400. Child care is free. Find out more and register at issuesetc.org. Or call 618-223-8385. The Fall 2018 Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 9th and Saturday, November 10th in Dallas, Texas. Ross, let's talk a little bit about some of the actual movement of the chess pieces, so to speak. What kind of institutional changes has Francis made that can help us understand him?
I mean, the institutional changes have actually been rather modest. And this is one of the ironies of his papacy, that the people who elected him at the conclave, the cardinals, were looking for someone who would effectively do a kind of house cleaning in the Vatican. There's a sense that the system around the Pope was just not working at all, and John Paul II had basically bypassed it, and Benedict XVI was constantly sabotaged by it. And so there was an expectation that he would do a lot of sort of internal Vatican reform. And there's been some stuff, some reorganization, some sort of financial house cleaning. And on the sex abuse front, there's been some move towards a system of greater accountability for not just priests, but bishops. But a lot of this has been either limited or very informal or highly personalized. You know, Francis will happily sort of reach in to different countries and dioceses to remove bishops who are misbehaving, which is something that Benedict and John Paul were less likely to do. But he's more interested in doing that than creating sort of permanent structures. And, you know, this may change, but next, you know, there's talk that there'll be a big dramatic reorganization of things next year. But people have been saying next year in this pontificate for the last 4 years. So in many ways, I think what's interesting is how sort of personalized rather than institutional the changes have been, with the caveat that the Pope's biggest power is the power to appoint the people who elect his successor. And Francis has made a ton of appointments to the College of Cardinals to the point where soon a majority of the cardinals will be his appointees. So that has presumably a very long-term, a powerful long-term effect on the church. Although everyone assumed that, you know, the appointments John Paul and Benedict made meant that you could never get a liberalizing pope, and yet here we are. So who knows?
John Paul is probably most fondly remembered as a great ambassador to Roman Catholic youth. There was something going on in his papacy that attracted youth from all over the world. Does Francis have the same thing?
I think to a point, yes. I think that he's very admired among the young. You know, if you look at, you can see this in polls, you can see it in conversations and so on. I would say, though, as with John Paul, there's a question of, you know, how this translates into sort of the ordinary life of the church, where, you know, if you look at the overall trends under John Paul, no matter how much sort of young people seemed excited by him, the general decline in sort of youth participation, youth church going, and everything else in the West continued apace. So there's a risk of sort of overinterpreting the kind of celebrity halo of certain kinds of popes. And again, I mean, I'm not disputing that at the attraction John Paul II had for people, but I think in the light of now 20 or 30 years of hindsight, we could say that the long-term effect of that charisma on the church isn't totally clear, and the same may be true of Francis. There may have been a John Paul II effect that, like the Francis effect, lasts as long as the man is sort of there traveling the globe, but doesn't always translate into, again, the ordinary life of church-going and religious practice.
I'm wondering whether or not, people didn't wonder at the time, but I have in the last 4 years wondered whether or not the elevation of Francis was in some sense a reaction on the part of the College of Cardinals to the short papacy of Benedict XVI. What do you think?
Well, it was clearly a reaction at the administrative level. You know, it was clearly a reaction where Francis was seen as an outsider to Rome. You know, with Benedict, they had elected the consummate insider, thinking, well, he knows where the bodies are buried, so to speak. Well, maybe not, so to speak. And, you know, he's the right man to do the cleanup that we need. And Benedict sort of started out strongly and seemed to lose energy and got sort of tangled by the Vatican bureaucracy. And so there was definitely a sense of sort of, you know, Francis as outsider, Francis as sort of austere personality. And then Francis wasn't seen as a liberal, but he was seen as sort of a moderate conservative. So I think there was a sense that, like, sort of moving the center of gravity a little bit away from sort of traditionalism was desirable. But I think that, you know, in terms of sort of the duration issue, I think the expectation when Francis was elected was that it would be another short papacy, and that he was to, you know, you were electing someone who was older. You know, he's had some health problems in the past, and I think the Cardinals didn't want to elect another John Paul II who could reign for 20 or 25 years. I think they imagined Francis being sort of a guy who could clean up the Vatican and then pass from the scene. And again, I don't think they expected him to be either a sort of dynamic, immediate figure or as theologically sort of rambunctious, if you will, as he turned out to be.
You had mentioned earlier a D.C. Cardinal Theodore McCarrick and the controversy that has been exposed surrounding him. What does Francis need to do about that? This raises the controversy to a whole new caliber.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of possibilities. I think when the larger sex abuse crisis broke in the U.S. church, one of the best things they did was the bishops set up a national review board that was led by laymen for the most part, and that ended up commissioning not just sort of recommendations, but also a kind of broad study of patterns of priestly sexual abuse, when it was at its worst, what the range, you know, the ages of who was victimized, all these kinds of things. And it was, I think, a really useful exercise of sort of transparency that, it, you know, you could actually have the church sort of order that kind of investigation of itself and use the findings to sort of take next steps. I think something narrower but similar is appropriate here. The fact that clearly, I mean, as I said in the column, I knew about Cardinal McCarrick. I didn't know the scope and the gravity and the fact that he preyed on people so young. But it was sort of an open secret for many years that he would, you know, harass seminarians and invite young priests to his beach house and all of these things. And the fact that, you know, and nobody could get, no one in my profession could get enough people to go on the record to break it as a big story. And the fact that that could be true, you know, if I knew about it, certainly people who were responsible for making McCarrick archbishop and a cardinal, people, you know, in his circle of friends and allies, lots of people knew about this, presumably. And sort of these kind of networks of secrets and silence is a big part of how predators tend to thrive within the church. They have secrets. Other people have secrets. They blackmail each other. They rely on each other. And I think it would be totally appropriate to have someone with sort of legal and investigative experience to do a report just on sort of the life and career of Cardinal McCarrick, who would have known about this, who could have stopped it, and so on. And then beyond that, there are more steps to be taken, but that's where I would start.
Finally then, Ross, I am a pastor in the Conservative Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod. Why should creedal non-Catholics like me be concerned about what a Roman Catholic Pope teaches and practices?
Well, you know, as a Catholic, it's because it's the one true church, so surely you should care. But even if you don't accept that theological premise, that, you know, Roman Catholicism is the largest Christian body in the world by an extraordinarily large factor. And its cultural influence is profound. Its influence on political and cultural debates inevitably has spillover effects for all of the Orthodox, but especially Protestant churches and denominations and communities that live and work around it and beside it. And, you know, the changes in Catholicism, the John Paul II papacy had a dramatic effect in different ways, I think, on sort of the shape of Protestantism in the United States. It created ground for alliances and dialogue with evangelical Protestants that hadn't existed before. It sort of pushed Catholicism away from the mainline Protestant churches, which Catholicism had seemed to be converging with. And in the same way, the Francis papacy will have a lot of influence on Protestantism in all kinds of different ways. Right now, Francis is sort of the leading figure for any kind of sort of liberalizing Christianity, I would say, sort of independent of the specific fact that he happens to be the Pope. He embodies a sort of revival of the liberalizing spirit of the 1970s in an incredibly important and influential office. And how his reign and his era and its effects play out within Catholicism will both influence and have, I think, substantial lessons for other communities that are often dealing with their own variation of the same divisions, the same issues, and the same debates.
Ross Douthit is an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. He's film critic for National Review and author of several books, including his latest, To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism. You can purchase To Change the Church and read his columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Ross, thank you very much for your time.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Hadley Arkus will be with us on the other side of the break. He's Professor Emeritus of Jurisprudence and American Institutions at Amherst College. We're going to be talking about abortion and the hearings for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Stay tuned.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.